In our study of Esther, we've come to chapter 8. I'll read the entire chapter. Esther 8, beginning at verse 1. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told him how he was related to her. So the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther appointed Mordecai over the house of Haman. Now Esther spoke again to the king, fell down at his feet, and implored him with tears to counteract the evil of Haman the Agagite and the scheme which he had devised against the Jews. So the king held out the golden scepter toward Esther. So Esther arose and stood before the king and said, "If it pleases the king, and if I have found favor in his sight, and if the thing seems right to the king, and I am pleasing in his eyes, let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, which he wrote to annihilate the Jews who are in all the king's provinces. For how can I endure to see the evil that will come to my people? Or how can I endure to see the destruction of my countrymen?" Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and Mordecai the Jew, "Indeed, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and they have hanged him on the gallows because he tried to lay his hand on the Jews. You yourselves write a decree concerning the Jews as you please in the king's name and seal it with the king's signet ring. For whatever is written in the king's name and sealed with the king's signet ring, no one can revoke." So the king's scribes were called at that time in the third month, which is the month of Sivan, on the 23rd day. And it was written according to all that Mordecai commanded to the Jews, the satraps, the governors, and the princes of the provinces from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces in all, to every province in its own script, to every people in their own language, and to the Jews in their own script and language. And he wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus, sealed it with the king's signet ring, and sent letters by couriers on horseback, riding on royal horses bred from swift steeds. By these letters the king permitted the Jews who were in every city to gather together and protect their lives, to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the forces of any people or province that would assault them, both little children and women, and to plunder their possessions. On one day in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, a copy of the document was to be issued as a decree in every province and published for all people, so that the Jews would be ready on that day to avenge themselves on their enemies. The couriers who rode on royal horses went out, hastened and pressed on by the king's command, and the decree was issued in Shushan, the citadel. So Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white, with a great crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple, and the city of Shushan rejoiced and was glad. The Jews had light and gladness, joy and honor. And in every province and city, wherever the king's command and decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a holiday. Then many of the people of the land became Jews, because fear of the Jews fell upon them. Just in case you're ever in a Bible trivia quiz, verse 9 is the longest verse in the Bible, at least in English translations, 78 words in the Authorized Version. So, in case anyone ever asks you, people, I think if they have to memorize a verse, usually memorize Jesus wept or something like this. This verse 9 might not be on the top of the list of verses people would want to memorize. Maybe better than a list of names. Okay, so we're in chapter 8. In the last chapter, we saw Haman executed by the king for... Well, it's not exactly clear what the king had in mind, but for God's own purposes, Haman, who was the enemy of the Jews, was executed, and his life is put to an end. But there still remains the fact that the decree against the Jews, the decree that the Jews should be massacred, is still in effect. We saw that earlier in the book, that was sent out by couriers to all parts of the province. It's already published. The date is known. And therefore, there still remains a tremendous threat, humanly speaking, hanging over the people of God. As we look at the details of this chapter, where that threat is in effect counteracted, I want to keep in mind the main theme of the book of Esther. I've tried to emphasize this maybe with mixed success in terms of my emphasis, but let's not get lost in the details of this. The book of Esther shows how God works by his providence to accomplish things that we would think impossible. God works in very subtle ways, in ways that are outside the control of men, you might say. The fact that Ahasuerus couldn't sleep at the beginning of chapter 6. And he also uses means to accomplish his purposes. But often the way God delights to work is to overturn the proud and to cast them down and to reverse the roles. And there's one verse in chapter 9 that particularly emphasizes that, and that's maybe a sub-theme of Esther in terms of the way God's providence works. But just so that we can remember and think again about God's providential care in the big picture before we look at the details of chapter 8, we see here this the counteraction of the decree. It's really an amazing thing. How could the decree to destroy the Jews given by an emperor whose decrees cannot be reversed, how can it be counteracted? And that's we see how God at least sets that in motion here. But I also like for you just to think through the chapter I just read to see how the reversals come through in various ways. For example, Haman had boasted of the greatness of his wealth. Where is his wealth now? It's in the hands of those Jews. Esther, and then Esther gives it into Mordecai's keeping. So right up front in the first verse, you see the overturning of that. Furthermore, Mordecai takes Haman's place. Mordecai is now the new grand vizier or second in command or whatever the title is, and even is given the signet ring that Haman had used to seal the first decree. Mordecai is given that ring to seal the second decree. And actually, Mordecai is given the task of writing the decree. Apparently, Ahasuerus can't bother himself with the details of his decrees, and just as he gave it to Haman to write the first decree, so now Mordecai is given to write this. And the decrees are actually closely parallel. We'll come back to that later. Mordecai is honored. So he is sent out from the presence wearing the royal robes. Tremendously impressive. It may not seem that way to us, but the way he's described in verses 15 to 17 recalls the king's glory in chapter 1. And it's a reversal, and as Mordecai stands for all of the people, it's a reversal of the low position of God's people. What was the reaction of the city to the first decree? Well, they were perplexed, right? What's going on? Why is this happening to the Jews? Whereas in this chapter, you see the city is glad. And what was the reaction of the Jews to the earlier decree? Well, there was mourning and fasting, and here there's great joy. And finally, in the crowning touch of God's providence, when Haman had sought to destroy the Jews, what does the end of the chapter say? The Jews increased. Gentiles converted to become Jews. So you see how God sits in the heavens and he laughs at those who would destroy his people, who would rebel against him, who would try to overthrow the Messiah. And here God, again and again in this chapter, shows his power to reverse the power of men. Now, that's, I hope, the big picture you'll keep in mind. And there are some details, including some maybe politically incorrect points that we'll talk about as we go along. But let's start looking at some of the details. I already mentioned that the property of Haman in verse 1 of chapter 8 was given to Esther. And then Esther, in turn, in verse 2, appoints Mordecai over the house of Haman. Now, this is, in terms of, you know, ancient Near Eastern justice, this is exactly the sort of thing that you would expect to happen. Haman was in effect, threatening Esther, although Haman may not have been aware that she was Jewish. And so, as a sort of a recompense for Esther, she was given his property. That's the sort of logic that they use then, and it makes sense. I've already noted that Haman boasted of his riches in an earlier chapter when he was recounting to his wife and counselors all the children he had, all of his wealth and his high position. And here it's given to Esther. One thinks of Proverbs 13, 22, the wealth of the wicked is stored up for the righteous. There are actually lots of places where Haman unwittingly illustrates the book of Proverbs for us, and and other things in this chapter not related to Haman. Then, so next in the account, so that was verses 1 and 2, next in the account comes the plea that Esther makes before the king. And again, because we're fairly familiar with the story, we might not think about the significance of this. Esther could well at this point have considered herself safe. After all, the king knows she's Jewish. They're not going to enter the palace and start a massacre against, try to kill Esther. And Mordecai presumably would be safe as well. Haman is dead. And so why does Esther bother to go before the king again? Okay, now, I mean, it may seem like an obvious answer to us because we're familiar with the story, but apparently she does this at the threat of her life again, because there's a reference in verse 4 to the king holding out the golden scepter. I mean, maybe he's fickle enough, you know, maybe he's forgotten her in a day. We don't know exactly how long it was, but Esther comes, and the word that's used in verse 3 for implore is a very strong word. It's she falls down at his feet, she's crying, and she, I think one commentator said this word emphasizes both the intensity and the importunity. That is, that she's going to keep at it. She's going to persist in this decree. And this sort of feeling toward her people is a very significant thing. I thought I would read Trapp again wins the prize for quotability. Matthew Henry's close. Trapp says about this, such was her holy sympathy and endeared affection to her countrymen and fellow citizens of heaven that she could not live to behold such a sad and bloody spectacle, that is the massacre of her people. Oh, how great is the number of those nowadays who have not the least parcel of Esther's spirit, but are all for themselves and for their own interests. And Trapp is actually quoting someone else there, but Trapp is making the point that, you know, we need to be, as the Puritans often said, public-minded, in the sense that instead of focusing on our own needs and our own interests, we also need to consider God's people and the needs of God's people and the threat against them. Two good biblical examples of this are in Exodus 32. Remember when God's wrath was against the people because of the golden calf? And what did Moses say? He said, blot my name out of your book. Blot my name out of your book instead of having your wrath fall on the people. Or think of Paul in Romans 9, where Paul said that his grief over the Jews' rejection of Christ was so great that he could be cut off so that they could be saved. Well, Esther isn't maybe quite the same position as an intercessor or mediator, but it's quite significant that Esther goes before the king and pleads for the people. Any comments or questions so far? There's an introduction in the first few verses. Any thoughts so far? Okay. Well, let's look then at verses, I guess we've more or less gotten ourselves down to verse 9. So let's look at verses 9 through 14. The king, actually at the end of verse 8, let's just take a notice. The king is responding to Esther's request. Esther is asked to counteract the decree. And the response of the king in verse 8 is to note that whatever is written in the king's name and sealed with the king's signet ring, no one can revoke. So you could think of that as sort of advice to Haman, who's about to write the decree. Haman, you can write a decree, but keep in mind that you can't actually revoke the earlier decree. Okay, so I'm going to come back to the point. It's a very strange and presumptuous law. I'll try to come back to that. But that's the situation that Mordecai finds himself in. He's told to write a decree to counteract an earlier decree, but he can't actually overturn the earlier decree. And so then we come to verse 9, as I noted, this long verse where the description is given. The reference is to the third month, in which this was written. So that tells you it's been 2 months since the original decree was written, right? So the execution, the massacre, was supposed to take place at the in the 12th month. So 2 months have already gone by, and that may be the reason why there's an emphasis on the swift horses in verse 10. Okay, they have less time, right? The might make joke about dial-up access instead of T1 or something like that. But they have less time here. They've got to get the message out. And that's a certain part of the emphasis in these verses. But the decree is actually described in verse 11 and 12. The point of verse 12 is easily enough understood. Whatever he's describing that the Jews are supposed to do is going to happen on the same day as the original massacre was supposed to occur. Okay, so it's not any earlier, not any later, the same day that's supposed to happen. And what it says in verse 11 is that the king permitted the Jews who were in every city to gather together and protect their lives, to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the forces of any people or province that would assault them, both little children and women, and to plunder their possessions. Now, that's the sort of politically incorrect point. What right do the Jews have to go out and massacre people if they weren't supposed to be massacred in the first place? Okay, so I'm going to talk about that a little bit. But the first thing you should notice is that this decree is an exact, parallel is probably too weak a word. It follows the earlier decree word for word, even down to the destroy, kill, and annihilate. By the way, Dave, I checked, and that's not the phrase that's on the monument. But there's sort of a similar threefold thing. But anyway, so the Jews are given the right to destroy, kill, and annihilate. The original decree referred also to the children, the little children and the women. Okay, and this does here. And the plundering of the possessions was also in the original decree. So, in effect, and this may be important, I don't think anyone really understands how a system like this could work, but if you have a decree that you're trying to counteract, it may be important to basically say word for word the same thing, but change the subject of the verb, as it were, so that now the Jews are the ones who are given this authority. Okay. Notice also that in the publication of the decree, the specific reference at the beginning is that it should be told to the Jews. I'm looking at the middle of verse 9. And then the satraps, the governors, the princes, and so on. So they are, in a sense, the first ones to be informed. They are of first importance in the spread of this decree. Now, what is it, the purpose of this? And here it may be helpful to notice one particular verb in verse 13. The Jews would be ready on that day to avenge themselves on their enemies. Now, the word avenge has a specific meaning. It refers to, okay, so this is what one commentator said, punitive retribution for prior wrong. Okay, so this is it's avenging in the sense that these are people who are being wronged and they have, they repay in a punitive way what had happened to them. Now, how do we understand this? Okay, as I said, there is something, if we weren't familiar with it, there would be something, I suppose, a bit shocking about reading this in the Bible. You know, the little kids in Sunday school are supposed to share their crayons with each other. They're not supposed to go out and attack the little children. Right? In Sunday school class, you're not supposed to talk about genocide as a good thing. Okay? This isn't genocide. But I hope you see there's something that we should at least talk about to try to understand. And this is similar to the sort of thing we looked at last week when I tried to explain Esther and the criticism that she didn't show mercy to Haman, which actually to my mind is somewhat ridiculous criticism. But this may be closer to something that we would struggle with understanding. It is self-defense in a sense. But I would say if you say only that the Jews are defending themselves, that really doesn't explain it fully. It's more than self-defense. But on the other hand, it isn't like wanton slaughter. It's not like you Jews can go out and kill any Gentile you like. Okay? Again and again, it's avenging themselves on their enemies. It's referring to those who would attack them. And so it's not wanton slaughter. They're not supposed to commit genocide against the entire Persian Empire except the Jews. That would be very difficult to do anyway. But it's not probably, strictly speaking, self-defense. There are actually several points that we need to sort of pick out of the passage to help us think about it. One other thing is to look ahead to chapter 9. I didn't read chapter 9, but if you actually read chapter 9, you'll see that it says specifically that when the Jews went out and fought, they did not lay a hand on the plunder. In fact, there's a certain emphasis on that. That point is repeated. So even though they were given the right, you might say, by Mordecai to take the plunder, they didn't do it. Okay, which would emphasize the fact that this is not about their own self-interest. And also, it seems that only adult males were killed. The account in chapter 9 isn't completely clear, but even though the original edict referred to women and children, apparently when the body counts are given in chapter 9, they refer to, like in verse 6 of chapter 9, 500 men, and it's referring to adult males there. It's possible that Mordecai actually never really intended that to happen, that this parallel with the original decree was supposed to be a formal sort of thing. He never actually intended for people to take the spoil or to kill the women and children. That's a possibility. Some commentators have suggested that simply announcing that the Jews had the right to seize the spoil and to take the women and children would be a deterrent to anyone who would want to do that. So it would act as in a way to scare off anyone, to discourage people from participating in the attack. One other point which Trapp makes, and this is a kind of an interesting observation, is that on the other extreme, so you might say on the one hand, what would keep the Persians from going ahead to make this attack? After all, the Jews are a relatively small group, and they would be greatly outnumbered in most of the places where they were scattered. So on the one hand, it's helpful to note that in chapter 9, the civil magistrate actually was on the Jews' side to enforce the rule. Okay, so that is, again, I'm pulling ahead from the next chapter to try to explain what happened. But in verse 3, all the officials of the provinces, and they list all these titles again, they helped the Jews because fear of Mordecai fell upon them. Okay, so there, it wasn't simply the Jews outnumbered against these people, but it was actually the force of law behind them. Now, in a sense, the force of law behind them was behind them in the decree, but I think any Christian who lives in a culture where the government is hostile to them knows that what's in the books is only a letter of law. I mean, how many times have we heard stories from India, for example, where Christians are attacked and the police just stand there? Okay, no. The police are supposed to protect every citizen. So that same sort of thing apparently did not happen in chapter 9 in the effect. So that on the one hand emphasizes that there was more protection for the Jews than you might think just from the letter of the law. But on the other hand, you might wonder, well, if that's the case, why would anyone even attempt to attack them? And I think Trapp makes a good observation here, and that is that these people could well have said, oh, there goes Ahasuerus again. Okay, so, you know, Esther gave him the sweetheart talk and talked him into this decree, but we really know that we still have the right to attack the Jews. And so it's possible that the enemies of the Jews still felt that they had the force of law on their side before they actually saw the opposition from the civil magistrate. It's a little hard to tell. But let's think a little bit about this irreversible decree business. Many of the commentators point out how ridiculous this is, okay, and how presumptuous it is. Some commentators make a parallel with the supposed papal infallibility, right? The Pope can declare things ex cathedra and, you know, he's always right. Well, better not contradict anything else that any previous pope decreed. So that's the problem when you have this continuing revelation, as it were, that you have the king, and whatever decree he makes, it can't be reversed. This is not the first time in the Bible, like in terms of biblical history where this reference to the Persians has come up. You go back to Daniel 6, 8, and 15. Remember Daniel in the lion's den? And I think it was Darius was all upset that Daniel had to go to the lion's den. But there was nothing he could do about it because he had made this decree. Okay, so it's the same sort of thing. It's, some have questioned whether this is actually historically accurate. Apparently there's some other extra-biblical references, but it seems fairly clear from the scriptures that this is the sort of way that the emperors operated. And one explanation might simply be that, especially in Eastern cultures, this abhorrence of losing face is a very big deal, and shame. Western cultures don't have exactly the same sense of shame that the Eastern cultures do, and which is a shame in some ways. I remember when Scott came back from the Middle East once, Scott McCullough told me that this is something striking in the even in the Arab culture, that they had this sense of shame, and that was actually one opening for the gospel, was to talk about it in terms of the shame of sin that the Western world has lost to a large extent. One thinks of gay pride parades, for example, as a complete example of a loss of shame. But here, that may be one motivation. The king has said, and he doesn't want to counteract what he said, and so he's not going to let the decree be reversed. Okay? Instead, he has to come up with some strange way to frustrate the earlier decree. And the best explanation of what this means is what I saw Matthew Henry said. In effect, what the king does through Mordecai is legalize a civil war. Okay? So before, the enemies of the Jews had every right to go out and attack the Jews, which is not, I mean, presumably that sort of thing wasn't allowed generally in the realm. They're still allowed to do that. But now the force of law is, as it were, shifted to the Jews. The Jews are allowed to defend themselves, and they have the force of the most recent law on their side. So you have this strange situation that the two are in tension with each other. Matthew Henry says this, "It shows the absurdity of that branch of their constitution that none of the king's edicts might be repealed, for it laid the king here under a necessity of enacting a civil war in his own dominions between the Jews and their enemies, so that both sides took up arms by his authority and yet against his authority." Okay? And that actually may go a long way to explaining the strange situation that the Jews found themselves in. Right? If the original decree could be overturned, then there wouldn't be any need for this Jews arming themselves and going out and attacking the enemy. Right? The decree is overturned and that's that. But because of this strange rule that no earlier law can be overturned, it seems that the only way to deal with that is to legalize a civil war and to put the force of law, especially behind the Jews, for the defense of themselves. Otherwise, the Jews who assembled to defend themselves, like if they were only under the first decree, could well have been punished by the law. You don't just go out and collect yourselves together to fight in the streets. That would be illegal. But this is now supported by the edict. To summarize the first part of what I'm trying to say here in terms of understanding it just in its immediate context before we step back and look at the larger biblical context, I thought I would read what Trapp says about this. He says, "This was no private revenge, but licensed by the chief magistrates, who were entrusted by God with the administration of his kingdom upon earth, by the exercise of vindictive and remunerative justice." He has in mind Romans 13. "He wrongeth the good that punisheth not the bad." And so his point is that the civil magistrate is appointed by God to defend the good and to put down the bad. And in that sense, it was a good decree. It's strange that you would ask the people themselves to take up the defense, and that may be connected with what I'm going to say next. But in terms of the immediate context and understanding how you deal with a dysfunctional empire, that, I think, is helpful in understanding the decree. At least it was to me. I hope it's helpful to you. But we should not also not forget the bigger picture. And I tried to make the point from the very beginning, especially when Haman was introduced, that Haman is there to represent all of the enemies of God who are seeking to destroy God's people. So you may have noticed in verses 3 and 5 in this chapter that Haman is referred to as the Agagite again, twice. Okay, so that emphasizes again the connection with the Amalekites. So it's been a while since we talked about this, but the Agagite refers to the princely title or the royal title among the Amalekites, who are an ancient enemy of the Jews. And God declared that there would be war on Amalek through the generations, and it seems to be taking up the whole biblical theme of the seed of the serpent seeking to destroy the seed of the woman. And that I think helps us to understand maybe in bigger biblical picture what's going on in chapters 8 and 9. In effect, the civil magistrate is enforcing the sanctions of the Abrahamic covenant. Those who curse you, I will curse, God says to Abraham. So here, the force of the civil magistrate is behind the cursing of the enemies of the Jews. It is to protect God's people. Now, that actually has interesting implications for the New Testament and how this stands as a promise of things to come, and maybe we'll come to that at the end, but those are some reflections on why I think God resolved the situation this way, working within the system of the Persian Empire, but also reminding us of the fact that God's war against Amalek continues from generation to generation. That more or less takes us down to the last three verses, which I actually want to spend maybe a disproportionate amount of time on, disproportionate to their length. But let me pause and see if you have any comments or questions. Does anyone think we should cut this chapter out of the Bible or something? Yes, Dave.
So it seems to me that a wise course of action, if you were an emperor whose edicts would not be revoked, would not make very many of them.
Yeah. But so you'd have a libertarian party kind of...
right. It seems like if whatever it is that you're going to say can never be revoked, that the last thing you'd want to do is make silly laws. And he seems to be particularly inclined to make some downright silly laws.
Yeah. It's a bad combination, isn't it?
It's a very good combination.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah. Yeah. Derek?
Hey, question about the vengeance, the idea of punitive justice. So the tens of thousands of people that tried to kill the Jews but instead were killed by the Jews, could part of the vengeance be for past persecution besides them just trying to kill them on that day? Like the people had come up in 180 said, oh, now we hate the Jews today. We didn't
right.
know anything about historical persecution of the Jews in this time?
Not that I know of, no. Now, I think the idea would be that everyone knew who the anti-Semites, as it were around. Haman had his followers throughout the province, and I think that's the implication of it. I don't know of anything that we would normally call a persecution before this. Of course, they were deported by the Babylonians. I mean, that's not a nice thing to do, but I don't know of anything before this. And, you know, it could be that people who had, in the past, sought to destroy the Jews thought better of it. And I think, as I read the decree, it's not giving permission, you know, in terms of past intentions. But I could be wrong. Other comments? So the last three verses are... especially striking in terms of the theme I tried to introduce earlier, which is the reversal of fortunes. The proud enemy, Haman, who sought to destroy the Jews, is cast down. Actually, not cast down, he's put up, but 75 feet up. But his fortunes fall, and the Jews are raised up. And I mentioned in verse 15, Mordecai comes out with, you know, royal apparel. So it's an absolutely astounding thing. There was a foreshadowing, you might say, in the chapter where he got to ride on the king's horse, and he had honor from an unhappy Haman. But here it's a very striking thing. But I especially want to notice the response in terms of joy and fear. So in verse 15 at the end it says, "The city of Shushan rejoiced and was glad." So this is the royal city where they were. There are actually a few of them, but this is where all these events were taking place. "The city of Shushan rejoiced and was glad." And then it says, "The Jews had light and gladness, joy and honor." And then in verse 17, it went beyond the city. It went out to the provinces. "The Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and holiday." And I already mentioned what a great reversal that was for the Jews from their earlier mourning and fasting. And then the end of verse 17, "Many of the people of the land became Jews because fear of the Jews fell upon them." Now, I mentioned that the book of Proverbs ties in very well with lots of parts of Esther. One pair of verses in Proverbs 11:10-11 are really quite appropriate. You know, I'll paraphrase, "When the wicked are in power, the city mourns, but when the righteous rules, the city rejoices." And that's a paraphrase. Look it up. But that's exactly the sort of thing you see here. The city rejoices. Apparently, Haman wasn't very popular, if you want to read between the lines. But they rejoice at what is being done. And this is not just the Jews who are rejoicing, but the whole city rejoicing. Or Psalm 126, you know, we sing, "The Lord has done great things for us, and we rejoice." But remember the verse, the part of that before that, "The heathen said, the Lord has done great things for them." And then the people of God say, "Yes, the Lord has done great things for us." So apparently part of what's going on with the joy that you see, as well as the fear, is a recognition that the Jews are a people especially blessed by God. God has shown his hand among them, and it causes the Gentiles to rejoice and also to fear. Now, just a few comments on the specifics. When it says that in verse 17 that many of the people became Jews, that shows, by the way, that the Jewishness is not merely a matter of, you might say, genetics. Okay? They became Jews. They joined themselves to the Jews. They professed the faith in the God of Abraham. This is something that you can see elsewhere in the Scripture, but not all that often. There aren't that many cases of this. You think of Rahab, you think of Ruth, and the book of Ruth, and there are some other references, but this is a relatively rare occasion in the Old Testament where peoples are willing to join themselves to the people of God. When it refers to the fear of the Jews being upon them, I tend to interpret that not as fear of the Jews' swords, you might say, but fear of the God of the Jews. And I'll come back to that point more or less in just a minute. But a couple of references in Acts are interesting here. When Peter preached in Acts 2, or later on in Acts 5 and the events there, it says that fear fell not only on the church, but also on the people who saw what was going on. And that fear resulted in conversions. But I think it's especially encouraging for us. Let me start again. Let me say it this way. I'm afraid sometimes, especially people in the 21st century, could be quite cynical in reading the last part of verse 17. Many people became Jews because fear of the Jews fell upon them. I mean, I'll speak for myself. I read that and I say, well, of course they became Jews. They didn't want to be executed, you know? So it's very easy for us to read that and say, well, these are all false professions. This had nothing to do with genuine faith. But I don't think we should be so cynical. I think the whole passage encourages us to realize that it was God doing something mighty among them that caused the Gentiles both to rejoice and to fear and to seek the God of the Jews. So this is a fairly lengthy quote from Matthew Henry, but I think he makes this point very well. He says, "One good effect of this deliverance was that many of the people of the land that were considerate," I think we would say maybe thoughtful, "considerate, sober, and well-inclined, became Jews, were proselyted to the Jewish religion, renounced idolatry, and worshipped the true God only. And he actually refers to the point I made earlier. Haman thought to extirpate the Jews, to destroy the Jews. But it proves in the issue that their numbers are greatly increased and many added to the church. Observe, when the Jews had joy and gladness, then many of the people of the land became Jews. The holy cheerfulness of those that profess religion is a great ornament to their profession and will invite and encourage others to be religious. So sad faces about being a believer in Jesus is not a good evangelistic tool. Then he goes on, the reason here given why so many became Jews at this time is because the fear of the Jews fell upon them. When they observed how wonderfully divine providence had owned them and wrought for them this critical juncture, one, they thought them great and considered those happy that were among them. And therefore they came over to them as was foretold in Zechariah. And I want to look at that reference in a minute. We will go with you, for we have heard, we have seen that God is with you, the shield of your help and the sword of your excellency. And he has in mind a reference to Deuteronomy also. When the church prospers and is smiled upon, many will come into it that will be shy of it when it is in trouble. And then two, they thought them formidable and considered those miserable that were against them. They plainly saw in Haman's fate that if any offered injury to the Jews, it was at their peril. And therefore, for their own security, they joined themselves to them. It is folly to think of contending with the God of Israel, and therefore it is wisdom to think of submitting to him. I think Matthew Henry well brings out the emphasis of the passage, which is not on what we would see as a sort of a cynical thing. I think largely the point of saying that many became Jews is to tie in with this great theme of reversal that we've already seen. But it does also tie in with a bigger prophecy of the Old Testament. So let's turn to at least one reference here, and that's in the book of Zechariah. We studied that not that long ago, so right next to the last book of the Old Testament. Zechariah chapter 8. We were reading this in family worship and read this a few days ago. Here in Zechariah 8, this was not a time of great prosperity in spiritual terms for God's people. They had returned to the promised land, but I would say there wasn't an overwhelming amount of enthusiasm for serving God in an isolated place. They maybe thought things were better back in Persia. Maybe Esther would counteract that idea, but here we are in the promise that God gives to people who are otherwise discouraged. Zechariah 8:20, thus says the Lord of hosts, peoples shall yet come, inhabitants of many cities. The inhabitants of one city shall go to another, saying, let us continue to go and pray before the Lord and seek the Lord of hosts. I myself will go also. Yes, many peoples and strong nations shall come to seek the Lord of hosts in Jerusalem and to pray before the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, in those days 10 men from every language of the nations shall grasp the sleeve of a Jewish man, saying, let us go with you, for we have heard that God is with you. That's especially that last verse, last part of that last verse that Matthew Henry has in mind. We have heard that God is with you. They saw the power of God in casting down Haman and in delivering them. Now, I'm not saying that all of what Zechariah is prophesying here is fulfilled. There's no reference to these newly converted Jews going to Jerusalem, or newly converted Gentiles going to Jerusalem as Jews to worship God. But this sense that they hear that God is among them, they see what God is doing, and they are encouraged to seek God. Zechariah was prophesying not that long before the events of Esther occurred. It's not like this is hundreds of years that it's taken for this at least down payment of the prophecy to be fulfilled. And there's much, much like this. So I listed just some of the references from the Psalms, Psalm 72, you might think of Isaiah. Our pastor preached in through Isaiah, and you may remember the references to the nations being gathered in to see, after seeing the glory of God. There are also references in Psalm 72 and Isaiah think the last two there in 49 and 60 of the, even the civil magistrate seeking to support the people. Well, that ties in with what I was talking about before, that in this case the officials of the provinces were willing to enforce the second decree. All of these are, I think, pictures of what God promises to do for his church throughout the ages. No, not that we're supposed to go out and slaughter our enemies, okay? I'm not saying that, but I'm saying the promise that God would gather in many nations and that even the civil rulers would seek to protect the church instead of persecuting it. Those are things that are prophesied in the scriptures. And I hope you'll read Esther 8, especially the last few verses, as an encouragement. In an amazingly difficult and desperate situation, God turns things around so much that the city of Shushan is glad, and many fear and believe in the God of Abraham. I'm not saying they were all genuine converts, by the way. Okay, I'm just saying don't let that be your first reflection. People think of Constantine, or Constantine becomes emperor, and now it's popular to become a Christian, and people flock in, and now the church is ruined. I really don't believe that's a very good description. It is true that there are false professors. Sometimes it's more popular to wear a WWJD bracelet or whatever it is. You know, after 9/11, everyone was in church. Everyone was very religious. Things like that happen. I'm just saying, don't despise that. Don't immediately say that there is no hand of God in it, but use discernment. Okay, I guess only I could talk for that long on 17 verses. Sorry. Any comments or questions? Any thoughts about Esther chapter 8?
Kind of a reflection of the mustard seed.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's right. And this is an encouragement that not to despise the day of small things, the small seed becoming greater. Good. Well, there are two more chapters. Chapter 10 is only three verses long. I don't think that's the shortest chapter in the Bible, but I haven't checked that. Anyway, but I do plan to take two more weeks, I think, to finish the book. Let's close in prayer.